This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Excellent. Now that we've agreed with that, we can now get on to agreeing that the St. Louis Cardinals should win the World Series this year.
No.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Brian Wilson of Education Policy, Dara Z. Handler.
I wish I had a beard as awesome as Brian Wilson.
And not to mention the mohawk. How is that a new addition, the mohawk?
It is. It looks like a Halloween costume, yeah. Like a Jack Sparrow Halloween costume.
Yeah, my sons are afraid of him as well. They should be.
Yeah, they should be because he's an awesome pitcher.
Yeah. All right. So for those of you listening, you should know that I grew up in St. Louis and Dara grew up in Los Angeles. So we have been having some rivalry this week with the big series. In fact, as we tape this show, they are playing in game five. And you know, by the time this airs, Dara, who knows? The Cardinals could have taken it all.
I don't think that's going to. Need I remind you what happened with the Cardinals and the Giants?
No.
3-1. He got all braggy. And look what happened.
You don't have to remind me. Thank you very much. It is fun here at Fordham. We've got the two of us. Joe, producer Joe, is a big Red Sox fan. And Brandon is, and Pamela, both from the Detroit area. Brandon is a real fan of the Tigers. So anyways, this is one of the great things about D.C. Everybody's from somewhere else. And in this case, we are from cities that have great baseball teams.
Great
Go
this year.
Cardinals.
Oh, Dodgers.
Yeah. In your case, great this year.
Yeah.
In my case, great almost every year, Dara.
Fine. I will accept that. This is a rare playoff appearance for us.
All right. Let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
For the last few months, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett has steadfastly refused to release $45 million earmarked for the Philadelphia schools until the teacher union has made major concessions, including a pay cut. But on Wednesday afternoon, Corbett agreed to release the funds, arguing that he was satisfied with the other reforms made by the district. Did he make the right call?
This is a great question. And before I looked into this, I would have said no, that of course you don't negotiate. And we're kind of in a perfect example of this with the government shutdown. You have to stand by the line that you drew. But I looked into it a little bit more and I found something interesting, which is that there were reforms that were made, including changing the way that teachers are assigned to schools and also some school closures. So I actually think this is smart because Corbett he got what he wanted in terms of no cost policies like teacher assignment. And even though the teachers didn't agree to take a pay cut this year, the $45 million is a one-time payment. And so he might get it again next year because it's only going to happen once.
Yeah, it's so hard sometimes outside of these cities to know who to believe or what to trust. I mean, the unions have been painting him as this evil man who will not release these needed funds for a city in distress. On the other hand, you know, the teacher union in Philadelphia has an incredibly generous contract compared to most other cities. And there is a financial crisis. And, you know, look, when those things happen, teachers need to be willing to do some give backs as well. And the reform community in Philadelphia has been pushing very hard to make sure that the contract was changed because, look, not only to get reforms that they wanted, but also to make the system more affordable. If you want to avoid these crushing cuts in terms of cutting, you know, closing schools, in terms of getting rid of nurses, which is a big issue. A boy tragically died of asthma this week. You know, if you want to do those sorts of things, then you've got to get the money from somewhere. And in education, the money is going to employees. That's where it's going. We've got to get some of that money back in terms of salaries and in terms of benefits if we're not going to have to cut everything else.
And that's what makes this so interesting is that he got these no-cost but really important concessions in return for a one-time payment. So you could argue, yes, this one-time payment is kind of capitulating. But on the other side, it's just like you said, this is going to come up again in a year. And people are going to be hopefully putting even more pressure on the teacher union to cut employee costs.
Yeah. Now, all that said, you know, Pennsylvania is one of the stingiest states when it comes to state funding for education, still largely based on local property taxes. Would be good to see them move as other states have towards more state funding, which tends to be more equitable. Of course, Michigan is probably the best state on that front and hasn't saved Detroit. I mean, look, you know, you just can't get out of the, you know, these big urban districts. They're hemorrhaging students, and you know, they've signed contracts that are unsustainable. these fundamentals you've got to fix, regardless of the larger picture.
And let's also be clear here that this was actually $45 million in a federal fund that Corbett was withholding. So he was slightly at risk for a lawsuit. And it's possible that he wasn't conceding to the union, but a bunch of other civil rights groups earlier this week had threatened to bring a lawsuit against him. So now he's getting pressure from both sides, not just the union. So perhaps politically savvy.
Topic number two, Pamela.
The Star-Ledger ran a two-month investigation on New Jersey private schools that specialize in serving severely disabled children using public dollars. What they found is a laundry list of questionable financial practices, from nepotism to the purchasing of expensive cars, and argue that this paints a picture of privatization without proper oversight. How should programs for special education kids be run?
So, you know, this is what we call private placement, right? This is when school districts say that they don't have the resources or the capacity or the expertise to serve children with severe disabilities. And so they contract out for those services. And we know all around the country, there's a whole cottage industry of these private schools that specialize in serving these students. Problem is, they charge an incredible amount of money, sometimes in the six figures. And as this article shows, the oversight is not always what it needs to be. I mean, this is a common issue with government contracting. Whoever is doing the contracting needs to make sure they have strong oversight. You don't want to micromanage, but you do want to make sure that, that certain controls are in place. And let's face it, Dara, this does not look great. Some of these schools had, you know, 10 family members on the payroll, all making big money. This looks like nepotism.
And I was actually surprised at the high percentages of schools that they investigated that actually exhibited these questionable practices. I was expecting a splashy headline, and then we found one school out of 180 that did this. But no, it was something on the order of 30-40% of schools had these relatives working in the same school, or contract buying services from companies owned by relatives, or salaries that were incredibly high. And so it was certainly surprising, if not sobering.
You know, there's an argument that says, look, we shouldn't care what happens at these schools or who they hire, you know, or even what they're paid if they deliver good results, right? If they deliver good results for a fair price, then, you know, who cares what happens inside that black box? The problem here is, first of all, this is costing a ridiculous amount of money, right? Second of all, it is so hard to measure results when you're talking about kids with severe disabilities. How do we know if they're providing quality? I mean, the article didn't really even get into that, right? Are these kids being well served for all this money? It's not hard to believe that if the money is getting siphoned off for these private interests, that they're not actually getting well served. We see this, look, in the charter school world, which is a form of contracting. We know that the people doing the contracting, the authorizers, have a critical role to play. And we've built up now over 20 years some expertise on what that looks like when done well. Who's in charge of these private schools? I'm not even sure, you know, who's the oversight body, and do they have any professional practices or you know, knowledge about how to do it and what the rules are, and making sure that these things are again providing a good service for a fair price.
Agreed. I don't think I have any direct advice on how to prevent this from happening, but certainly looking into the situation is important.
All right. Thank you. Topic number three, Pamela.
Mike, you argued recently that schools and society as a whole should spur on the strivers, including by allowing them to cluster in high tracks or in exam schools. Dara, do you buy it?
I feel like any answer that I give to this question is going to be hypocritical, because I attended a highly gifted magnet school in Los Angeles Unified School District and would never have achieved the quality of education that I received if I was not clustered with similarly high achieving students in a highly gifted magnet school.
See, this was a trick question. I knew that Dara was a classic striver. So yes, I mean, how can you not answer yes to this?
Because I'm an N of one. Who's to say what would have happened if I had attended a traditional public school? It's this question of differentiated services, almost that we were talking about before. Is it better to have a school that can provide extremely specialized services to a niche population? Or is it the duty of a comprehensive high school to teach both the high and the low?
Yeah. All right. Well, let me explain my larger point here, was that in many of our efforts in education, and also in the broader anti-poverty world, a lot of focus goes on the very toughest cases, you know, the most disadvantaged kids with the most dysfunctional families and the most tragic stories. And by all means, those children deserve our attention, our empathy. You know, they deserve services. But what I worry about is then we end up crafting policies or programs that are so focused on the toughest cases that we ignore the needs of the kids who might not be, who are still needy, who are still low income, who are still disadvantaged, but maybe not quite as disadvantaged, you know, who have some parents who might have it, you know, kind of have it together and are encouraging them, you know, to do well in school. Rick has talked about this in an NRO article this week, that we should not disadvantage these parents that are behaving well. So we want to encourage particularly low-income kids to strive to get out of poverty, to go to college, or to take a career track that's going to get them a decent paying job, and we should clear their path. And one way I believe my reading of the research is that high achieving kids do best around other high achievers. And so at least for part of the school day, I think we need to make sure that kids are around other high achievers so that they can move at a fast pace, they can be in a culture where it's cool to be smart, and they can achieve their full potential, and that those are the kids who are the best shot to make it out of poverty. And we've got to put a fair amount of resource into them.
I was with you on up until the point where you talked about separating these students. So I do completely agree that the strivers are neglected, and it's kind of this pendulum that swings. You know, we talk about the strivers, and then we talk about the low achievers, and then we talk about the high achievers again. So I completely agree that we need to pay more attention. Is the best way to do this by offering specialized classes, specialized tracks? I still don't know. And I think that you run a risk of letting the courses that are for the lower achieving students, you kind of give them a pass because you say, well, this is not for the best kids, so it's okay that in this class, being smart is not cool because you have the other class where being smart is cool.
All right, but that's fair, Dara, but okay, I think we can have a high track without also having a low track. I mean, we used to have three tracks. Low, regular, high. Let's have regular and high. Let's work to make sure that regular is still challenging, does not have dumbed down low level stuff, that has good teachers. I mean, all of that, by all means, we don't want dead end tracks. But I don't think that means that we therefore take away. I mean, I was on the radio this week in California, this district that decided they're going to have open access for advanced placement courses. But they have scarcity because they don't have enough teachers to teach enough of these courses. So they've decided to enroll kids by lottery. By lottery. So the A student who's worked hard and is really ready to do well in AP doesn't get in, and the D student who's been blowing it off does get in. Would we field a varsity football team this way by lottery? Of course not, because we take sports seriously in this country. If we took academic achievement seriously in this country, there's no way we would do that.
But if we took academic achievement seriously and followed by your there is no low track, then there would be, for example, honors courses with highly effective teachers for those students that might not necessarily be AP ready. Fine. Instead of shuffling them down into the not so high achieving, not so great classes.
Deal. Excellent. Deal. Now that we've agreed with that, we can now get on to agreeing that the St. Louis Cardinals should win the World Series this year.
No.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You following the baseball like Darren and I?
Not too much. I'm not Orioles fan, so you know.
So sad.
Yeah. I know. After them, I don't really follow anybody else. So
yeah.
Sorry about
Can
that.
Can I recommend the St. Louis Cardinals? I mean, look, almost every year you got a shot at the playoffs or you're in the playoffs.
It's clear that Amber likes the underdog, therefore the Los Angeles Dodgers should be her team of choice.
St. Louis, that is an underdog city. I mean, I'm watching the Dodgers game. You got all those fancy Hollywood types over there in this fan. Oh, look at that person, that famous person. Not in St. Louis. They are regular Joes in St. Louis, drinking their Budweiser. Unlike those fancy people in Los Angeles. Okay.
I can't contribute much to this. Now, if we talked how bad the Redskins loss was the other night, I can talk about that. But
oh, I watched that too.
That's a sad story. All right. What you got for us, Amber?
A new report out by the National Student Clearinghouse called National College Progression Rates. It tracks college enrollment and persistence for high school students across the country. Looks at graduating classes from 2010 to 2012. Just a couple little methods things. It's not a nationally representative sample. It's a voluntary sample. If you know anything about the Student Clearinghouse, they actually, high schools pay to participate and get their students tracked. Anyway, but it's a big sample, 2.3 million students over 3 years, about a quarter of all U.S. high school grads, and roughly 15% of public high schools, so that's not too shabby. Divide students by their demographics, income, minority, urbanicity. But no surprises. Sorry, it's not the most exciting report. But anyway, here's the unexcited findings. Results show for the class of 2012, students from low-income schools had lower college enrollment rates. Big surprise. Mm-hmm. 50% from students from low-income rural schools, 55% for students from low-income urban schools. Oh, high-income, low-minority urban schools, 70%. Looks at college preparedness, meaning basically do kids who are enrolled their first year after high school actually remain the second year in post-secondary. Class of 2010, they found that persistence rates for graduates of all high schools were high, 79 to 88%. Yet, high-income high schools had higher, did I get that right? Higher-income high schools had higher persistence rates than low-income high schools. I mean, this is like common sense, right? Yes,
right, but now we can prove it.
Private schools and universities were higher than public institutions. Persistence rates were higher for 4 years institutions than 2 years. I mean, this has to do with the kids that are enrolled in these places. Anyway, I mean, I just found it was kind of a snoozer. Sorry, but it just seemed to like tell us what we already know. But I guess, yeah, now we got a data point to point to it. And they do say, you know, kids are delaying college more and more, maybe because of the economy. They're juggling school with employment. So there's some contextual stuff that sort of, you know, mm-hmm. folks are reading it, trying to read into it. But the report itself is just, it's a lot of tables.
So the big headline in the papers was that it was income or class, so we say, rather than race, that seems to be driving these differences.
Well, I don't know how they got that from that report, right? Because it's a descriptive study.
Yeah,
I mean, they are a very big, fat caveat that mm-hmm. you cannot say any of this is causal and it's completely descriptive. So
right, or at least related, right? That,
yes.
That, and we've seen this in other studies recently, right? That we know there's been more progress closing the black-white achievement gap mm-hmm. than we have seen, according to Sean Reardon, about closing the sort of class-based gap. Mm-hmm. Of course, those two things overlap quite a bit. I don't know if you saw that interesting Richard Rothstein piece last week where he mentioned, and this, I guess this has been well known for a long time, but that if you control for social class correctly, in his view, comprehensively, that it explains the black-white achievement gap. Mm. You know, in other words, it's not an additional racial achievement gap. It's just that you know, even if blacks and whites that might have the same income, there's other differences around, you know, broader conceptions of social class that explain these differences.
I mean, this goes back to sociological theory and Karl Marx, where you're talking about cultural capital and whether it's possible to, whether you can throw money at a problem, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or is it you need cultural capital, social capital, connections to people that help you move up the societal ladder, yeah. help you understand the value of an education, not just you need to get one. Mm-hmm. This is not a new argument.
And here, then again, we have these colleges where we talk about, you know, university policy all the time, and yet it's what? Only something like 20% of their students at this point are these traditional students going straight from high school into college, right?
That's right.
I mean, that most of the higher education enterprise now, you could say 80% is more akin to adult education.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
going back, you know, after working, after doing other things and trying to get their degrees. And that's where a lot of the money is going now.
Right.
And yeah. A lot of the focus.
I mean, I think that's what this report says, you know, especially with the economy like it is. The trends look a little different. I mean, maybe it was in the Post a couple weeks ago where we've got, you know, lots more students getting master's degrees. The bump is even higher than it was, and it mm-hmm. was pretty high a few years ago. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are grasping at straws in some way, like, you know, what do I do now? I can't get a job. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
I'll go back. Amber, I am trying to make something out of this study. Can you see?
This is like
stone soup over here.
It's really
okay?
Rough.
I'm doing what I can.
It was tough. It was slim pickings, but I know for a fact next week I got a good study.
Oh, woo.
Yee-hoo.
Can we give a hint?
DC Impact. New
DC
study on DC Impact.
I like
by
it.
By some really good researchers, so it should be good.
I like it. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, Amber. We're looking forward to that that stronger study. Be focused on the Research Minute next week. Until then,
I'm Darcy Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli. Go Cards at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
That was not fair.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.